The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Reader's Digest, and will also have a bonus article from the Saturday Evening Post. Our first article, Why Our Bodies Don't Dig Daylight Saving Time. Twice a year, when we spring ahead and fall back, we're more prone to sleepiness, depression, and accidents, by Teresa Carr. In the summer of 2017, when Professor of Communication Jeffrey Gentry moved from Oklahoma to accept a position at Eastern New Mexico University, he was pleasantly surprised to find it easier to get up in the morning. The difference, he realized, was early morning light. On September mornings in Portales, New Mexico, Gentry rose with the sun at around 6:30 a.m. But at that time of day in Oklahoma, it was still dark. As the Earth rotates, the sun reaches the eastern edge of a time zone first, with sunrise and sunset occurring progressively later as you move west. Gentry's move had taken him from the western side of Central Time in Oklahoma to the eastern edge of Mountain Time. Following his curiosity into the scientific literature, he discovered the field of chronobiology, the study of biological rhythms, such as how cycles of daylight and darkness affect living things. I really just stumbled upon it from being a guinea pig in my own experiment, he says. In 2022, Gentry and an interdisciplinary team of colleagues added to that body of research, publishing a study in the journal Time and Society that showed the rate of fatal motor vehicle accidents was highest for people living in the far west of a time zone, where the sun rises and sets at least an hour later than on the eastern side. Chronobiology research shows that longer evening light can keep people up later, and that, as Gentry found, morning darkness can make it harder to get going for work or school. Western edge folks may suffer more deadly car wrecks, the team theorized, because they are commuting in the dark while sleep-deprived and not fully alert. Time researchers make this point, and study results and public opinion polls reflect it. Something is awry about the way we mark time. Those problems start with the annual toggle between Standard Time, ST, and Daylight Saving Time, DST. Poll after poll finds most people unified in their dislike of switching clocks back and forth with the season. However, the question of whether to stick with Standard Time or Daylight Saving Time year-round once again sends people to different camps. Scientists generally advocate for permanent Standard Time, or natural time as some people call it, because it better aligns people's schedules with the sun year-round. People who study the issue are all in agreement, Gentry says. On the other hand, public opinion tends to favor permanent daylight saving time, and many politicians agree, perhaps because of the positive associations with summer sunshine. A bill to make that switch passed the U.S. Senate unanimously in 2022, but then stalled in the House. A new version was recently introduced. Some scientists have fired back that such a move would be a grave mistake. The German newspaper Die Welt quoted pioneering chronobiologist and sleep researcher Till Ronneberg, warning that permanent daylight saving time would make Europeans dicker, dummer, und grantiger, fatter, dumber, and grumpier. The conflict over daylight saving time versus standard time makes for grabby headlines, but the research reveals uncertainties not only about the effects of changing the clocks, but also about other factors, such as how structuring our schedules around light and darkness could have a profound impact on our health and safety. The 24-hour cycle of light and dark created by the Earth's rotation is the force that rules our lives. Homer's rosy-fingered dawn is what chronobiologists call a Zeitgeber, German for time-giver, a natural signal that touches off cyclical processes in the body governing our internal clocks. Morning light, for example, cues our bodies to ramp up production of cortisol, a hormone that helps us feel awake and alert. Meanwhile, as cortisol dwindles through the evening, darkness triggers the sleep-promoting hormone melatonin. In the language of chronobiologists, the biological clock rhythms of humans and other animals are entrained, or determined, by the solar clock. Humans have devised schemes such as time zones and daylight saving time to optimize their interactions with these natural cycles of light and dark. But the match between time policy and the Zeitgebers is often imperfect. When we set clocks forward with daylight saving time in the spring, many people suddenly have to get up for school or work before the light has jump-started physiological processes associated with wakefulness. Cortisol levels peak about an hour later during daylight saving time, according to a 2014 Australian study. Then, at the other end of the day, people may have to go to bed before hours of darkness have signaled to their body that it's time to sleep. The abrupt change, especially to daylight saving time in the spring, can wreak havoc on our health and safety. In a 2020 commentary for JAMA Neurology, Beth Mallow and colleagues in the sleep division at Vanderbilt University Medical Center outlined evidence of negative health effects during the daylight saving time transition, including less and poorer quality sleep, an increased risk of stroke and heart attack, and a decreased sense of well-being, particularly for men who work full-time. In addition, although the research on road safety is mixed, some studies find an uptick in traffic accidents and fatalities in the days after the daylight saving time switch. However, those bad effects are fleeting. The longer-term impact of daylight saving time is hard to research because the amount of sunlight changes with the seasons. Only one study has directly compared permanent daylight saving time to permanent standard time. A 7-year study of students ages 10 to 24 living in northwestern Russia, when the government mandated a switch from seasonal daylight saving time to year-round daylight saving time in 2011, and then switched again to permanent standard time in 2014. Permanent daylight saving time meant that the sun rose and set later in the winter. Results published in 2017 associated year-round daylight saving time with a greater likelihood of feeling down in the winter, as well as sleeping later on weekends, a phenomenon known as social jet lag. Chronobiologist Roneberg and colleagues coined the term nearly 2 decades ago to describe the chronic sleep deprivation that people experience when they have to get up for school or work before they would awaken naturally. Social jet lag is the umbrella term for not being able to live in sync with one's biological time, says Roneberg. It's an artifact of our modern world. Nearly half of American adults sleep at least an hour later when they have the chance, according to a study published in JAMA Network Open in 2022. Others have associated social jet lag and the sleep deprivation it reflects with smoking and consuming higher amounts of alcohol and caffeine, as well as a range of ill health effects, including obesity, metabolic syndrome, a group of health conditions that increase the risk of heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes, and depression. Studies have also linked social jet lag to worse academic performance for high school and college students. In a thorough review, Roneberg and colleagues argue that by pushing sunrise and sunset an hour later, permanent daylight saving time is bound to worsen social jet lag. But the Russian study is the only direct evidence of that link, and it's uncertain whether those effects, which the Russian researchers characterize as small or very small, apply to older age groups or people living where the cycles of light and dark are less extreme. In Vorkuta, one of the three cities in the study, for example, the sun never rises for 10 days in the winter and never sets for 6 weeks in the summer. Polls show that we generally dislike mucking with time twice a year. Nearly two-thirds of Americans say they want to eliminate the changing of clocks, according to a nationally representative survey of 1,500 U.S. adults conducted by The Economist magazine and market research company YouGov in 2021. Permanent daylight saving time enjoys bipartisan support among many political leaders in the United States. In a document supporting the Sunshine Protection Act, Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, cites evidence that daylight saving time promotes health, safety, recreation, commerce, and energy savings. However, some of that research focuses on the harms of switching back and forth. So one could also use it to support year-round standard time. A 2020 report from the Congressional Research Service, prepared for members of the U.S. Congress, did not find substantial evidence that daylight saving time improves health and safety, or that it reduces energy consumption by much, if at all. On the other hand, the nonprofit organization Save Standard Time lists endorsements from more than 30 sleep science and medical organizations, including the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, the American Medical Association, and the American Academy of Neurology, among others, in addition to individual scientists and researchers. The last time we tried permanent daylight saving time, it didn't go well. In an attempt to conserve energy, Congress established a trial period of year-round daylight saving time in late 1973. But public approval dropped precipitously as Americans faced the reality of dark winter mornings. By October 1974, the country had reverted to 4 months of yearly standard time. The disconnect between the perception and reality arises because of how we think and talk about the seasons and time changes, says Malow, who testified before Congress about the benefits of permanent standard time. People have associated being on standard time with it being cold and winter and dark, she says. Meanwhile, springing forward coincides with the return of warmer, longer days. But, of course, daylight saving time doesn't buy you more light. Winter days are short, and summer days are long, regardless of how you mark time. The focus on issues like daylight saving time and time zones, some researchers say, can overlook another key part of the time policy puzzle. In our artificially lit world, our internal clocks are affected by far more than sunrise and sunset. No doubt the sun is the strongest Zeitgeber, but artificial light also affects our internal clocks, says sleep researcher Dirk Jan Dietsch. He dismisses the notion that humans are entrained solely to the sun as a romantic idea. We, to a large extent, have divorced our activity schedules from the natural light-dark cycle, he says. A body of research shows that even dim light can suppress our melatonin production and delay sleep. Blue light from fluorescent lights and our ubiquitous screens, which has the shortest wavelength and highest energy of light that the human eye can see, has a particularly powerful effect on circadian rhythms. Too much blue light at night can lead to problems with sleep, concentration, and mood, and a heightened risk of cancer, depression, and diabetes. Dietsch is frustrated that a focus on daylight standard time overlooks harder questions about the built environment and how we choose to live and work. The more general question is, how the heck do we actually come up with our work schedules and social schedules, which basically determine to what extent we make use of natural light versus man-made light, he says. because there's no question that aligning our sleep and work schedules with the light that is available for free would ultimately be better for us. That was Why Our Bodies Don't Dig Daylight Saving Time by Teresa Carr. And now a bonus article from the Saturday Evening Post, Floral Fantasy. The Philadelphia Flower Show ranks as the nation's largest and one of the world's most spectacular, by Amy S. Eckert. When the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society debuted its flower exhibition in 1829, the public was awed by a lineup of impressive plant specimens, including one never before seen by American gardeners, a brilliant red poinsettia, direct from its native Mexico. Nearly 200 years later, the Philadelphia Flower Show continues to captivate attendees with displays of rare plant species and dramatic arrangements of familiar varieties. The event is the oldest such exhibition in North America, and it ranks as one of the largest and most prestigious in the world. In celebration of America's 250th anniversary, the show's 2026 gathering reflects on the nation's horticultural history with the theme, Rooted: Origins of American Gardening. Towering floral arches, vine-draped sculptures, trickling water features, even live butterflies take center stage at the Philadelphia Flower Show, which spans approximately 13 acres in Philadelphia's Pennsylvania Convention Center. Whether designers make use of armloads of common daisies, bouquets of exotic orchids, pots of miniature jewel-toned roses, or wispy grasses and sprawling ornamental bushes, or all of the above, the show's botanical creations can only be described as works of art. I was surprised by the magnitude of the Philadelphia Flower Show, says Rosemary Wilson of Raleigh, North Carolina, who attended the show for the first time in 2025. The smells, the colors, the creativity, the spectacle. You walk into the convention center and you're immediately presented with a million cut flowers. It's hard to describe just how big, how amazing this show is. Joanne Greco moved to Philadelphia in 1991 and has attended the flower show nearly every year since arriving. Greco loves the show's entrance, which she says is always grand, eye-catching, and fantastical for its tendency to combine flowers that would never appear side by side in the real world. But she more typically gravitates toward the smaller pieces. I love seeing the entries in the plant competitions, says Greco. Potted geraniums, potted roses, jewelry made of botanical pieces, each with a judge's notes on them. She finds the amateur entries as compelling as those created by professional designers. It's interesting to see what earned this one a blue ribbon as opposed to that one, says Greco. And then decide for yourself whether you agree with the judges. Both women emphasize the value of a flower show visit, even for those who aren't gardeners themselves, and both speak of the joy of visiting the event in late February. Outdoors, it's still winter in Philadelphia that time of year, says Wilson. While the sky may be gray and dreary outdoors, the atmosphere inside is anything but. It really is good for the soul to see all those flowers in bloom, she says. The Philadelphia Flower Show traces its roots to November 1827, when 53 prominent Philadelphians joined to form the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. Being the green thumbs they were, members couldn't refrain from taking their favorite potted plants to their monthly meetings. Beloved foliage specimens, heady perfumed flowers, and oddball vegetable varieties regularly accompanied the society members to their gatherings. It's likely the members brought their burning gardening questions to the meetings, too. Why is this plant drooping? What's causing my fern to drop its leaves? What's the best way to propagate this vine? And how do I combat a persistent case of powdery mildew? 2 years after their inaugural meeting, the plant enthusiasts decided to open their botanical show and tell to the public, marking the first presentation of the Philadelphia Flower Show. Except for a few years' gap during World War II, the show has continued ever since and has grown almost exponentially. In contrast to the one-day shows of the 19th century, today's Philadelphia Flower Show, still a project of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, takes place over 9 days, drawing some 250,000 attendees annually. Most visitors hail from the Boston, Washington, D.C. corridor, but show organizers expect attendees from all 50 U.S. states and from abroad. In 2026, as the show considers American history and the tradition of American gardening, the theme, Rooted, Origins of America Gardening, will examine established cultivating practices in the U.S., the evolution of gardening methods, and the ways in which horticulture has shaped and been shaped by other cultures. Award-winning floral and landscape designers are expected to create large-scale installations that reflect the Rooted theme. In addition, the Philadelphia Flower Show will continue its long-standing practice of holding expert and amateur plant competitions, horticultural lectures, botanical craft-making workshops, gardening-themed children's activities, and a large marketplace where attendees can purchase seeds, plants, gardening accessories, and clothing. Gardening is an integral part of the American story, according to Seth Pearsall, Vice President and Creative Director of the Philadelphia Flower Show. In fact, the list of early American statesmen who were also avid gardeners is long and includes such heavyweights as George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison, and Benjamin Franklin, the last himself a Philadelphian. A lot of people in that time had their own cideries, particularly in this region, says Pearsall. And to create cider, you need fruit. So yes, those early Americans were big gardeners, cultivating both ornamental and kitchen gardens. Highlighting that origin story now at this landmark in American history only makes sense to the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. But flower show organizers hope that attendees will consider the botanical backstories not merely of America's political forebears, but of those within their own families. Gardens aren't just made, declares the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society website. They're passed down through generations, carried across oceans, lifetimes, and lands. Every seed carries a story. Those stories are personal, says Pearsall. We all have memories tied to plants, whether through the nostalgia of a grandparent's garden, a family recipe that revolves around freshly picked backyard herbs and vegetables, a mother's love of cut flowers on the kitchen table, or the heritage traditions that shape how we plant, grow, and gather. My family are farmers from western Kansas, so I've got a long tradition of people working the land, Pearsall says when asked about his origin story. But my earliest memory of gardening is of my mom working in the backyard garden that she had. Pearsall describes his mother's garden as having undulating borders with space enough for kitchen vegetables on one side and flowers on the other. He remembers the latter bursting with brilliantly colored lilies in the summer. It was a little plot of paradise, he says. The members of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society believe that every American has their own gardening story, each as important to the weaving of the American fabric as its historical or political narrative. And the Society hopes that a visit to the Philadelphia Flower Show will spark attendees' memories and foster conversations about the impact of those gardens on our lives. When Philadelphia's botanists gathered to form a horticultural society in the 1820s, they did so in part to share their love of plants with like-minded individuals. But their stated intention was to further the health and well-being of Greater Philadelphia through the creation of parks and green spaces. That founding principle remains central to today's Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, which utilizes proceeds from the Philadelphia Flower Show, its largest fundraiser, to improve life for residents of the city. Projects spearheaded by the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society include the provision of organic growing supplies, tools, and gardening know-how to volunteers in more than 170 community and urban gardens. The organization funds and oversees the planting of more than 3,000 trees each year and has helped to transform more than 12,000 vacant lots into city parks through the removal of trash and the planting of grass and other foliage. The Society has also installed rain barrels and rain gardens for more than 6,000 Philadelphia residents, and members offer horticultural and landscape management training and employment opportunities for those interested in green careers. The Philadelphia Flower Show is entertaining, says Parasol, but it kicks off 365 days of doing great work with gardens and trees and plants. That work is also a part of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society story. And chances are that those urban greening projects, what Parasol refers to as garden goodness, will find their way into new generations' horticultural origin stories. Amy S. Eckert is a freelance travel writer, author, and photographer whose work has appeared in numerous publications, including the National Geographic Traveler, AARP, AFARM, and the Chicago Tribune. For more information about the author of this article, visit amyeckert.com. And that was Floral Fantasy by Amy S. Eckert. And lastly, a very short piece from Life in the United States from the Reader's Digest. I handed my purchase to the clerk at the thrift store and said, "I just turned 68 and would like to receive a senior discount, but I don't have any proof of age on me." Before the clerk could object, the woman in line behind me came to my defense. "She's buying a CD of John Denver's greatest hits. What more proof do you need?" And that was by Carol Tanis from Jenison, Missouri. And now we have run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.